the gospel. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" He called a child, whom he put among them, and said, "Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever becomes humble like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me." The word of the Lord.
As Pastor Aaron noted a few weeks ago, one of the pieces of advice that Reformed theologian Karl Barth gave to preachers was to preach with the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other. He did this so with the idea that we bring the redemptive story of God to bear on the current events of the world, so that our allegiance to God might shape our allegiances in the world instead of the other way around. And as I was reading our Old Testament lesson for today on this 4th of July weekend, I couldn't help but think of the way this story about crossing borders of difference is a powerful counter-narrative to large swaths of the North American evangelical imagination. For I think those of us raised, especially in white U.S. evangelical churches, were shaped by stories that largely praise borders and walls as good and right. It's not difficult to see this, obviously, in the American psyche, as immigration, especially along our southern border with Mexico, continues to be a charged political issue, and the promise to build a wall, one of the largest parts of our former president's platform. And we see some of the terrible fruits of this position in the over 50 deaths of migrants this last week in the back of a truck, all made in the image of God. But this obsession with borders and walls has also played out in more subtle and not so subtle ways in U.S. history, from racial segregation and busing and redlining and gated communities to the absolute right to private property and the defense of that property at any cost. But it's also played an oversized role in many of our evangelical imaginations. Instead of national borders and walls, so many are passionate about this as well, we build theological and ideological ones. If you don't believe this particular bit of doctrine, or you do believe this one, you're cast out beyond the walls of the community into the outer darkness, where there is, I'm assuming, weeping and gnashing of teeth. While this past annual meeting was a welcome respite from this general trend in the Covenant Church, we know that our denomination has been part of this wall building and exclusionary practices, especially when it comes to the queer community. It has been decided, we have been told over and over again, that it is this particular line on which the validity of biblical witness, and therefore Christianity for some reason, rises or falls. The border must be clear, and the walls we have built must keep the chosen in and the others out. And as a church that tends to be more evangelically progressive, we have largely rejected these exclusive notions, at least intellectually. We often think of what it does to the people cast out. And we should. The church has done great damage to people we have cast out, whether they're people of color, women, the LGBTQ community. And we should lament and repent and seek reparation when we can as part of the Christian practice and witness. But I think today's Old Testament lesson suggests that it is also the people that are doing the wall building and border monitoring that in their very zeal often miss the small but powerful work of healing and transformation that God seeks for them. So let's pray. God of little things, God who speaks through enslaved little children to bring healing and bypasses the power of kings, may your words remind us where to look for your movement, not in the halls of power, but in the wilderness among the prophets. Amen. Today's Old Testament lesson begins in a way that sets up an almost immediate contrast between the big and powerful on the one hand and the small and powerless on the other. Listen to how it starts. Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Aram, was a great man, in high favor with his master, because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram. So he's a commander, a great man. The Hebrew translation there could also mean a big man, in high favor with the king and given victory from the Lord. But there was one problem. The man, though a mighty warrior, suffered from leprosy. In the Bible, the word leprosy can mean many different skin conditions and diseases, but all of them were dreaded in the ancient Near East because they made the sufferer ritually unclean and often segregated from the rest of their community. Naaman was most likely powerful enough to avoid that level of social ostracism that people with lower social status would have experienced, but his leprosy still would have had social consequences, not to mention the ongoing physical discomfort. So here is a big man who has everything, power, prestige, wealth, and yet a small skin condition threatens his status in the community. How could he obtain the healing he so desperately sought? As a big man, he was willing to use all of that power and wealth and prestige to find healing. But then we're told of another person. The chapter continues. Now the Arameans on one of their raids had taken a young girl captive from the land of Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my lord were with the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." On the one hand, we have a man with almost unlimited power, second in command, general of an army, mighty warrior, highly favored. And then we're told of another person. We are never told her name. People that low on the social status aren't even given a name. All we are told is that she was an Israelite, enslaved by the Arameans during a raid, and that she was a young girl. Again, the Hebrew here can mean both young and little. She was a little girl. So right here, we have a stunning contrast, named versus unnamed, powerful versus enslaved, insider versus outsider, big man versus little girl. In that society, and indeed in most societies to this day, this was about as stark of a power differential as could be imagined. It placed almost an impenetrable wall between these two people. And yet this little Israelite girl, who has every right to hate the people that enslaved her, for some unknown reason took pity on this man and crossed the border that divided them to tell his wife that there was a means of healing his leprosy, the prophet of Samaria, who we know is Elisha. By any of our human notions of justice, I think most of us would agree that it was well within this girl's right to ignore the suffering of her oppressor, at the very least, and maybe even silently enjoy it. Perhaps some of us even chafe at the idea that she would help this man who had caused her and her community so much harm. And I think this is a really interesting and vital conversation to have, especially within those communities that tend to be disenfranchised or disempowered in our societies. But as a community where many of us tend to have more relative power, I want to focus less on why the girl offers healing and instead focus on Naaman's response. We can all agree that the girl's response shows radical, maybe even foolish grace, but what is the call for those of us in relative positions of power when we are offered such grace? Naaman here is offered his first choice. He could, as many in his position no doubt would, ignore this nameless enslaved girl. There were such differences that separated them. What could she possibly know? He was a big man, she was a little girl. But he was also a man who was in dire straits, someone whose illness had made him willing to try anything, even if it seemed foolish, to bring healing. And maybe that's the first lesson of our text. Maybe it's when we've come to the end of our rope, when we have tried everything within our power, it is then we are most open to the work of God that comes from the most unlikely people in the most unlikely places. It is then, in our greatest moments of desperation, that we are sometimes willing to ignore the borders and the boundaries and the walls we have built to seek out healing. Yes, Naaman was desperate enough to try anything at this moment, but as we'll see, this really didn't change at first his fundamental mindset. He still believed that healing and change would come from the top down, from those in powerful and prestigious positions. For what did he do when he received this information from the little girl? First, he went to his king, the king of Aram, and had him write a letter to the king of Israel. And then he loaded his cart with a treasure trove, 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of garments to sweeten the deal. This was the way, or let's be honest, this is still the way that power so often talks. Have your people talk to my people, and maybe a few gifts, a couple campaign contributions can grease the wheels a little. But when the king of Israel read the letter and saw that the king of Aram expect him to cure Naaman of his leprosy, we are told his response wasn't exactly reassuring. When the king of Israel read the letter, our text says, he tore his clothes and said, "Am I God to give death or life, that this man sends word to me to cure a man of his leprosy? Just look and see how he is trying to pick a quarrel with me." The king of Israel, viewing this exchange through the lens of power and fear, saw this as a trap. He was being given a task he had no hope of accomplishing as a pretext for the king of Aram to exact revenge when he was unable to do what was impossible. Again, we see this contrast between the great and the small. The king of Israel sees only threat, but it's the little enslaved girl of Israel who continues to point to the promise of healing, not found in the halls of power with the king, but in the wilderness with the prophet. So Naaman again has to adjust his expectations and cross another border to find the prophet at his humble home. I love that image. It says all his chariots and horses came to Elisha's home. You can almost picture this, right? Like this huge, today it would be like all these black Suburbans maybe coming into a, you know, a small house, and they're coming to the prophet. But Elisha doesn't come out. He sends a messenger. And the messenger says, "Go wash in the Jordan 7 times and your flesh shall be restored and you shall be made clean." With these last few social indignities, all of Naaman's simmering frustration finally comes to a boil and he lets loose. "I thought that for me he would surely come out and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and would wave his hand over the spot and cure the leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?" He turned and went away in a rage. As is often the case, it is finally when Naaman gets good and mad that we at last see on full display the social and national borders and walls that he's constructed around him. Socially, he expects this nobody prophet from a conquered land not to send out a messenger, but to come himself to meet him because he's a powerful man and to respond with proper deference. "I thought that for me he would surely come out. For me, he'd be willing to do his magic, wave his hands a few times, say abracadabra, and heal the leprosy on my skin." And nationally, he knows that as the conquering power, that his country is better than this backwater nation that has been easily defeated. "Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel?" It's an interesting commentary on this 4th of July weekend. Naaman's social and national position threatened to erect a border wall that would keep out the healing he so desperately desired. And again, it's these unnamed servants who cross the border once more to speak wisdom and grace, though they would be well within their rights to keep their mouth shut and let Naaman choke on his pride. "Father, if the prophet had commanded you to do something difficult, would you not have done it? How much more when all he said to you was, 'Wash and be clean'?" Again, the Hebrew is illuminating with the something difficult being the same word translated as big or great when describing Naaman. So it's as if the servants are saying, as a big man, you would have welcomed a big show of strength, right? You would have welcomed the hero's journey to accomplish the feat, to defeat the dragon, to bring about healing. Can your pride take the idea that it won't be a difficult task? It won't be a hero's journey to a distant land that will earn you the healing you seek, but instead the opposite. Not the upward way of power and heroism, but the downward way of weakness and humility. To the shores of not your great rivers in the nation you so love, but the small and muddy river in a foreign land that you had conquered. Naaman apparently sees the wisdom in the servant's argument and dips himself in the Jordan and finds the healing he seeks. His skin, we are told, becomes like a little boy's, the same little that is used to describe the enslaved girl. In effect, his healing begins when he crosses that border of his status, when he listens to the little girl, and then his healing is to become like a little boy. Here we hear the echoes of what Jesus will say. You must become like a little child in order to enter the kingdom. Both the means of his healing and the effects of his healing are brought about by being open to the small and the little. Perhaps the lessons from this story are becoming more and more obvious, but I think they bear saying as unambiguously as possible. Borders and walls might make us feel safe. They might make us feel certain. They might make us feel right. But walls don't discriminate on what they keep out or in. And the walls we build in the impossible effort to protect ourselves will often be the very walls that keep out the work of God's transformative healing in our lives. And for those of us with relatively large amounts of power, privilege, and possessions in our world, the warning is even more pronounced, I think. As one commentator noted, the story also implies that material advantages may hinder a believer's perception of God. I think this point is essential because it suggests that sometimes we don't even know that we are walling ourselves in. For when we spend our times amassing wealth or gaining more possessions, we don't realize that each of these possessions, all this stuff, can serve as another stone in the wall that separates us, often unconsciously, from those around us. As the saying goes, the more things we own, the more our things own us. Because God uses the small, the outsider, the unnamed, to be a source of healing, we are most likely to be able to see these movements when we choose lives of simplicity that don't erect these walls around us. And I believe this is a challenging question the text confronts us with. What borders do we draw and defend? What walls do we build around us that might keep us from God's work of healing in our lives? Obviously, there are times when we have good and necessary boundaries in certain relationships. These aren't what I'm referring to. Instead, like Naaman, I wonder what walls we build are between ourselves and the people who our culture or our group considers outsiders, whether that's because of race and religion or culture or political affiliation or gender identity, sexual orientation, or a host of other social and cultural identity markers. Can we begin to question, to even tear down these walls? And I'll be the first to admit that I'm not always sure how this is done, but I believe part of this work involves being in proximity and relationship with people that are different from us, sharing meals together, spending holiday weekends together, watching kids together, living life together. By transgressing boundaries of difference, I believe we put ourselves in situations where we are more likely to see God's healing work in our lives and our world. And I believe this also holds the key not only of the challenge of this text, but the good news of this text. Even with all of Naaman's power and privilege and pride and prestige, God still cares desperately about his healing. God still wants Naaman to experience transformation. And even when we have built walls of power and privilege around us, God is always working to bring healing and transformation to our lives. And when we lose hope in our leaders, whether they be politicians or Supreme Court justices or denominational bigwigs, this story reminds us that this is often not where the locus of God's movement is. This isn't always where God is working. God does not give wisdom to the powerful military man, but to the unnamed slave girl. Not to the king in their halls of power, but to the prophet in the wilderness. Christ does not want us to become like the powerful leaders of the world. Christ wants us to become like little children of his reign. And on this weekend where millions will play patriotic music and blow off fireworks and have barbecues, often to celebrate political and military power, it is good news that God uses little things seeds, yeast, loaves of bread, sparrows, wildflowers, children, that God uses the small, the forgotten, the overlooked and unnamed to bring healing and wholeness to the world God so loves. All we need is the eyes to see. Thanks be to God.